WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The town hall meeting. There is no finer distillation of democracy, no prouder purveyor of the true will of the people. Sit back and glory at the town hall meeting in action.
We have to make judgments very fast and give about.
Percent haven't changed since the Bush administration.
You're lying to me.
That was just a montage that we lifted from The Daily Show. I'm surprised no one was screaming Attica, Attica, or No Roger, No Rerun, No Rent in the background. The town hall meeting has been criticized as of late for being filled with angry shouting people who either were or weren't put up to it by sinister forces, or maybe they were just simply angry on their own, and certain radio talk show hosts happened to share their anger, not vice versa. For this discussion, I do not want to dwell on the issue that's been dominating what's been going on so far, namely, is it AstroTurf or is the outrage real? I want to talk about the format and the forum itself, the town hall meeting. How democratic and representative is it? Seems like a good question to ask in a representative democracy. My guests are Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Hello, Julian.
How are you?
Good. And Carolyn Lukasmeyer, who runs town hall meetings sort of that are better than any of the kind we just heard. She's the president and founder of America Speaks. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, Brian. Delighted to be with you.
Oh, it's Mike, but that's okay. I won't yell at you for...
Mike. My apologies.
No problem. Julian, I want to ask you, you know, from what we've seen, have we just seen a couple people take advantage of a weakness in the system? Or should we begin to question if town hall meetings are point blank useful at all?
Well, I don't think we would want to get rid of town hall meetings. I mean, there are so few areas at this point where citizens can actually interact with politicians and express their views and question public policy and decisions that we wouldn't want some rabble-rousers or AstroTurf representatives to eliminate a tradition that we've had for a very, very long time. That said, I think a lot of people are disturbed by the kind of tenor that has, you know, prevailed in the last, certainly, round of the healthcare debates, and we need to rethink how we can stop that without stopping the town hall meeting.
So here at a radio show, we often get people who disagree with each other. And what I do is I like to screen the participants and mostly only invite professors from Ivy League schools. They can't do that in a town hall meeting. Are the people who are conducting these meetings getting something wrong in terms of the ground rules and allowing this to happen? What do you think, Carolyn?
Well, it's very challenging because the way that congressmen have typically done town hall meetings when they go home on breaks is just open it up and publicize them publicly.
And that's worked so far for them.
It has usually worked. Yeah. However, it does without question bring in more of the usual suspects. What we've been able to do in working with a lot of offices and members of Congress is teach them how to do the outreach so that they actually get a representative sample of their constituency in their town hall meetings. As Julian said, what we're seeing now is the poison of partisan politics that has been so evident in Washington being imported into local town hall meetings. And I think that will call for extraordinary measures to shift the balance, to set strong ground rules, to have a moderator in the room besides the member of Congress, and to reestablish the core principles, respect for civil discourse, and a commitment to hear all points of view.
And your group, America Speaks, does a couple kind of different town meetings. In fact, don't you have an interactive one where the aim is really for the people leading the meeting to not just get people to vent to them, but actually get constructive ideas and even have sometimes people vote on which direction to take a project?
Absolutely. I mean, the tragedy of what we're seeing in America today on health care reform, we actually did our style town hall meeting for Governor Schwarzenegger and the Democratic leadership in California in 2007. And 3,500 demographically representative citizens and residents of California looked at the six policy options, made recommendations to the governor and the assembly and the Senate. 77% of what they recommended were embedded in a new bill. It passed the assembly, the subprime mortgage disaster happened, and it lost in the Senate by one vote. So are Americans able to come together and study the options and collectively make choices for the common good? No question about it. But you have to build a safe democratic environment. And what we're seeing now is truly a distorted situation.
Is your phone ringing off the hook by members of Congress saying we need to do something better than just putting out the call for anyone who wants to show up so they can act like they're guests on MSNBC or Fox?
Well, I'm concerned that given the kind of browbeating many of them are getting, their gut reaction will be to back off public engagement. And what we need is more public engagement, but engagement that is designed to match the principles of town meetings as they started out in New England 233 years ago.
Now, Julian, you're a professor of history. You're also an expert in Congress and legislatures in general. Can you tell us a little bit about the history? The town meeting in New England seems to be a lot different from the town hall meeting, and I don't even know where that phrase came from. Maybe you do.
Well, we have, I mean, there's different venues. You have the New England town meeting, which we've had now, you know, since the founding of the country and before, where citizens are involved not only in asking questions, but the idea was citizens involved in actual governance. You also have, you know, a long tradition, you can find this, of legislators talking with their constituents in, you know, a community arena like takes place today. If you look at any congressional archive, it's filled with accounts of these kinds of meetings. They can often be incredibly rambunctious. Legislators used to spend a lot more time back in their states and districts. They weren't in Washington so much, and the vacations or recesses weren't as tightly scripted, so they were actually in the community a lot more than they are today. So you had both the town meeting, you had legislative encounters, whatever you want to call them, legislative meetings, and I think since the 1970s, you've had much more choreographed formatted encounters during the recess period as legislators, you know, fly back for August, and that's what we have today. So I think it's a variation on things we've had, but the kind of interest group participation that we're seeing, the kind of choreographed nature of it makes it very different, and I think for many, less satisfying.
Are town meetings or town hall meetings favored by Democrats? Because I don't recall any town hall meetings to explain why the Patriot Act was a good idea, although when he was campaigning, President Bush would often have pre-selected audiences, as President Obama does also. So is there a partisan divide here?
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, in the 70s, when the conservative movement came of age, there were many kind of comparable venues where legislators who were, you know, Republicans tied with the conservative movement were back holding these kind of meetings over things like the Panama Canal treaties to build opposition to it. So I'm not sure, you know, if you measured it, how partisan this is. But certainly there are certain issues that seem to escape the attention of the citizenry, or politicians don't give as much space for discussion.
Do you think the shouting and the lack of decorum is actually good strategy? Because those are the clips that get played on TV news and cable news. And actually, they're the clips that we're playing on our show because they're the exciting clips. But is it good strategy or bad strategy if you oppose health care or whatever version of health care they're going to pass to, you know, act like a lunatic at a town meeting?
Well, obviously, at this point, the strategy is to create the impression of great unease and unrest, both for the media, so you play the clip and then someone listens to it and thinks, boy, people are really unhappy with this bill, and obviously to scare the legislator, like Senator Specter, to shake them up a little before they cast that vote. So in that sense, this kind of tactic works. The danger is for the protesters, there's a backlash against them, that they take on, you know, an appearance of of a mob. Or the AstroTurf stories really kind of raise questions about, is this legitimate or not? And then you have questions about the protesters. But at this point, I think they have been able to shape debate much more than the administration was hoping for. And, you know, in the first of Obama's town hall meetings, he spent much of his time kind of defending himself and responding to the criticism, often, you know, that is not factually based, that is being raised in these town meetings and by politicians. So right now, I'd have to say it's worked.
Yeah, and you referenced Senator Specter, our own Specter of Pennsylvania. He was in Lebanon, Pennsylvania yesterday, and he encountered this guy.
I am going to speak my mind before I leave because your people told me I could.
I don't know. I think that might have been the man who was on the cover of the New York Times today. It certainly didn't work out for Arlen Specter. Carolyn, if I was a representative or a senator and I came to your organization, I said, just give me some pointers. I don't want to have to cancel them, but I don't want them to devolve into chaos. What are some of the things I should do to make them work out better for me?
Well, you'd change the physical space to begin with, Mike. You, instead of setting it up auditorium spot style where it's all going to be just direct Q&A of the member of Congress, you'd actually set up round tables in the room and seat people by randomization of where they came in. So you wouldn't have all the protesters standing together in one small geography. You would, in fact, fill the room with people who are process facilitators who set the norms of how the discussion will go. And you'd have some of the time back in what was intended, as Julian said, of people actually involved in governance, mm-hmm. where they would discuss together, what are the core issues we feel about a public program? What are the core issues we feel about the finance and adding to the federal debt? So you'd take the issues that all both sides of the aisle and that the protesters are very concerned about, but you would set up a circumstance where the people in the community are discussing it together, and then they speak with voice to the member of Congress at a certain stage of the meeting. But currently, the geography of the meeting, the physical setup, makes it very amenable to being taken over by protesters.
So maybe congressmen should redirect some of the budgets of their office, which usually goes to the franking privilege, sending out a lot of mail. I mean, it costs a little money to hire the people to do this, no?
It does, but frankly, we've found in most communities across the country, people are really concerned, and healthcare is the preeminent issue in which they're concerned. Many people who do this kind of facilitation professionally are more than happy to do it pro bono and to take a neutral stance on the issue to ensure that other members of the community really have the opportunity to have their voices heard and that you actually leave the meeting not understanding what a bunch of individuals believe, but understanding what the collective voice of the community is. Now, unfortunately,
as far as pay, how much would someone like Arlen Specter pay to not have had to go through that incident? It winds up being penny wise and pound foolish.
Well, my guess is at this point he'd be very willing to invest in a truly civil discourse.
Let me ask you, Julian or Carolyn, you can answer this too. Is there something disingenuous about the politicians who claim this is a town meeting, but really they want it not to be a dialogue. They want it to be a one-way conversation where they convince the people showing up or at least get their point across. And it's not like they're really open to suggestions, are they? So maybe they're asking for some of the trouble they're getting. What do you think of that?
Well, of course. I mean, politicians are politicians, and I doubt that many go in with a totally open mind. Most of them have, you know, their positions set. They have their read of the electorate. But that said, that doesn't actually matter. The point is to give a forum for citizens without creating the impression of a wrestling match to actually challenge the, you know, preconceptions of what the legislator is thinking and to push them and to actually have a dialogue. That can be an incredibly healthy environment for not only citizens but legislators. But if we have this kind of format, that predisposition of a politician to just go in, talk, and leave and go right back to what he or she was doing, this actually facilitates that. And so, you know, it's incumbent on citizens to make sure that's not the environment we have.
Have you seen any examples of town meetings, either with this debate or past debates, actually changing the politician's mind?
No, but, well, there was, yeah. I mean, during the Panama Canal Treaty, which I come back to, it was a really hard fight because conservatives were mobilized against what Jimmy Carter wanted to do, and there were town meetings across the country, and there are several legislators who ended up voting for it, where these kinds of discussions turned out to be incredibly important. They saw there was more support sometimes than they thought had existed. So I do think it can have an effect.
And was the rumor that people were put up to it by Manuel Noriega? Go ahead, Carolyn.
Another example of that had a very profound effect in the Social Security debate back in 98 and 99, right, when the special interest advocacy was all focused on privatizing, we actually had the opportunity to do town hall meetings in all 50 states, 55,000 Americans, and it did change the debate because in Congress at that point, there were no bills that had anything to do with raising revenues. It was a cap on the payroll taxes at that point. And what was learned very quickly, we repeated Austin, Texas, Des Moines, Iowa, Seattle, Washington. We saw in an instant that it was above 60% support in the country for raising the payroll taxes as part of the solution to help save Social Security. And it's people who are listening who know that's now happened twice since 1999. So it's clearly a place where inside the Beltway, the belief was the American public would not support an increase in tax revenue. When they got out and listened to the public, they were more than willing to support it. And the biggest surprise was that people who earned over $200,000 a year were also willing to support it. So it was easy for them to come back to Congress and introduce a bill that actually raised the cap on payroll taxes. That's about as fundamental a change as you can create in the American Congress.
I am Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our number for this town hall meeting of the air is 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. And the last guest you heard was Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who's the president and founder of American Speaks. Also, Julian Zelizar is on the line. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We'll take a break for just a moment. I'll come back. Mike Pesca on WNYC and for Brian Lehrer, talking town hall meetings with Carolyn Lukensmeyer and Julian Zelizer. And let's take a call. Phil from Queens. Go right ahead. Phil, you have the floor.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
You know, I have a few points that I'd like to make. Carolyn seems like a handler more than a facilitator. The town hall should be open to everyone. A buddy of mine and I went to town hall yesterday, and since we're conservative, we're against the health care plan for various reasons.
Who was sponsoring it? Which official?
Rather not say. The long and the short of it is, the first thing they said is, who sent you? You know, for years, liberals have gone to town hall meetings. They've screamed about AIDS or immigration or Cindy Sheehan could disrupt a meeting of the president, and nobody complained. The media always showed it.
Mm-hmm.
But God forbid, people who genuinely feel like their health care is in danger or with cap and trade that their energy bills are going to go up, and Pelosi and these other people demonize the American citizen. The town hall should be the last bastion where everybody should speak. My congressman is a good guy. That's who we went to yesterday.
Was it Anthony Weiner? I know he had one.
Where he has stayed for hours and hours and has heard everyone. That's the way it should be. That's what we pay them for. And I think this man at Spector's hearing was not allowed to speak, so he started to shout. That's what's happened.
Phil, was it Anthony Weiner? Because I know he had one yesterday.
There are a lot of congressmen having
them
all around.
You won't say. But no, I get your point, and I thank you for the call. And it must be very frustrating if you have this honest belief, and then you go to a town meeting and you present your belief, and all of a sudden someone says, oh, you were sent there by with a set of talking points from Glenn Beck and sent there by Rush Limbaugh. So is the defense being mounted by some Democrats counterproductive, Julian?
Well, I mean, I think that what the caller said is, A, totally legitimate and important. No one wants voices drowned out, and no one wants town halls where certain people are let in and others are not based on their political beliefs. But it's hard to just blame Democrats for this. I mean, there is evidence that conservative organizations on this particular bill have really flooded the town hall and tried to shape debate with talking points. And the tactics that are used in some of these are not just citizens saying, hey, how are we going to pay for this? How's it going to affect my insurance? But yelling down the other people, not allowing discussion to take place. So the effect then is not just to harm liberals and supporters of the administration. It also hurts conservative citizens because this is the reception they get. That's the corrupting influence of these kinds of activities. So I think he's right, but I think we have to look at the causes more carefully.
And to echo what the last caller, Phil, said, David from Glen Rock, who I'm not going to take your call, David, but I'll read your point, which is people who attend town hall meetings are vocal about issues, so it's natural that a shouting match can happen. Carolyn, what do you think of that?
Well, the essence of a democracy is for people to actually respect and listen to each other's points of view. And that doesn't mean you can't get emotional and passionate about it. But, and I'm sure Phil and David, just hearing them on the phone, I'm sure when they present their issues, they're doing it reasonably. And they're doing it in a way that someone else could speak. But we've all seen the clips of where it is clearly the intent of the speaker to not make it possible for another point of view to be heard. And that's the distinction. It's we need to take, whether we do it ourselves or whether we need help doing it from a moderator, we need to have some norms about ensuring that every voice is heard, because that is what a town meeting is for.
Julian, play hypocrisy police with me. Here are the charges. People call the Republicans hypocrites for engaging in disrespectful behavior that they profess to despise, like when Cindy Sheehan did it, we just heard Phil said, right? They didn't just like what she was saying. They liked the disrespect it showed to elected officials. Democrats have been called hypocrites because they get all apoplectic when the masses who are threatening disobedience happen to be in disagreement with them. Little hypocrisy on both sides?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think this is a conservative issue. I mean, on this particular bill, I think that's where the disruptive tactics have come. But certainly there have been liberal organizations that have practiced similar tactics in recent years. It's when you cross the line. So I don't think this is about Republican versus Democrat. I think this is about, you know, what kinds of behavior are legitimate in the town hall meeting, and then what should the role of purely Washington-based interest groups be in shaping and influencing these town hall meetings, as opposed to genuine grassroots movements. Look, conservatism in the 70s was a genuine grassroots movement with citizens mobilizing, coming to these meetings. Part of what conservatism has turned into today are Washington-based interest groups sending people to these meetings. And so that's what we're talking about. But this is not a right-left issue, not conservative liberal. I totally agree.
And
it's definitely a behavior issue, and it is partisan politics driven by interest groups now distorting what has been a form that has by and large been satisfactory to link their elected officials with their constituents in a town hall meeting.
Now, Julian, we know that some politicians are good at speeches and some are good at fundraising. Do you know of elected officials who are particularly good at this forum?
Well, one of the famous moments, although it wasn't this kind of forum exactly, was the presidential debate between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush when they used a town hall meeting or kind of audience format. I don't know if you remember that. And Bush was looking at his watch the whole time.
Yeah, and then
And Clinton was brilliant in terms of responding on the spot to what people were saying, really being able to listen and kind of speak in a way that was not intimidating and that was responsive. And for me, that was a quintessential moment of kind of what a politician wants to do in this kind of forum.
I think it was in Richmond, Virginia, and some woman asked about the deficit, and Clinton stepped forward and said, "How does the deficit affect you?" And the Republicans went crazy because they realized she wasn't really asking about the deficit; she was asking about the economy.
Exactly.
But Clinton just intuited it. Well, anyway, I want to thank both of you guys because you were respectful and B, not put up to it by a large tentacled organization above you. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is president and founder of America Speaks. I am Mike Pesca, and I'll be back tomorrow on The Brian Lehrer Show.